Good afternoon. My name is Robert Bullard, and I am currently the dean, as of a week, of the Barbara Jordan and Mickey Leland School of Public Affairs at Texas Southern University in Houston, Texas. For me, that's full circle. I started my career way back in 1976 in Houston at Texas Southern University, a young professor of sociology, and so I'm back. Growing smarter, achieving healthy, sustainable communities through environmental justice. This title is a take on a book that I wrote in 2007, MIT Press, which I tried to bring together this whole idea, concept, and lens around this issue of the environmental justice movement, the smart growth movement, livable communities, and sustainable development movements. And because for a long time there were different movements that traveled different tracks, and what I in all the various meetings that I had attended, it seemed to me that there should be some glue that would pull these different divergent movements together. Smart growth is something that is defined as growth that is economically sound, environmentally friendly, and supportive of community livability. Growth that enhances our quality of life. Smart growth is development that serves the economy, the community, and the environment. Now, that's a pretty standard definition of smart growth. But what I wanted to convey in this book was we can grow smarter, but we also should grow fairer. In the context that as we grow greener and develop this green green economy, we should also address equity, fairness, and justice, and particularly those issues that we consider legacy issues, things that we have swept under the rug, in some cases under the house, that we have buried, we're embarrassed to talk about, we're uncomfortable to talk about. And so in this context, growing smarter, achieving livable communities, environmental justice, and regional equity. That's the title of the book. How we define environment. The environmental justice movement more than three decades ago redefined environmentalism and environment. The environment is defined as where we live, where we work, play, where we learn, where we worship, as well as the physical and natural world. That doesn't leave a lot out. And so when we talk about these pieces and how these different parts are moving, and in some cases, as I said before, in some cases they're clashing. In some cases they're going on separate tracks, never the twain shall meet. And so when we talk about this whole issue of the principle of environmental justice embraces the principle that all people and communities are entitled to equal protection. Our environmental laws, health laws, employment, education, housing, transportation, civil rights. We're talking basic human rights. We're talking about health as the centerpiece of this whole notion of smart growth, sustainability, equity, etc. So when we get all of these different ratings, every year different magazines come out with the best places, and we all want to live in some of the best places, the safest place, the healthiest place, the top 10 fittest cities, the greenest, the cleanest, the most walkable, the most park-friendly, the most sustainable, most accessible, most livable. Now, we know there is an opposite. And that opposite, where many of the people that I work with, they're fighting like hell to flip that coin from being the most dangerous city in the country. And whether it goes, whether it fluctuates between a Detroit or New Orleans or Atlanta, you start talking about the day. Nobody wants that tag. And people who live in those cities are not proud for their city to be tagged the safest, I mean the dangerous, most dangerous city, or the fattest city. We start looking at these things. So we know the built environment impacts health. Where you live oftentimes can be very predictive in terms of your health, in terms of your zip code, your street address, your neighborhood. And so we're talking about space. Space and health are intertwined. And so when we talk about the built environment and infrastructure, environmental quality, all have direct impact on health and well-being. And so we have great tools today, mapping tools, and we know the initials, GIS, that can really give us great color maps. And what we can do is we can map vulnerability, the geography of vulnerability. And what I'm going to run through quickly are maps of the United States that map vulnerability. These are not my maps. Some are from government, some from agencies, so you can really believe them. Okay, there are different belts. There's the Sun Belt, there's the Black Belt, there's the Poverty Belt, Fat Belt, Diabetes Belt, Food Desert Belt, Stroke Belt, Asthma Belt. We're going to go through some of these belts, mapped. The healthiest states, this is from Forbes. You can really believe this. The healthiest states in the nation. Look at that regional bias. Vermont, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Hawaii, Minnesota. Any missing regions? The Dixie, South. Look at the unhealthiest states. There's a regional bias. 7 out of 10 unhealthiest states, according to Forbes, are in the South. The Southern United States. Every year these rankings come out from Forbes, Mississippi and Alabama is fighting to see who's going to be 50. That's not a good ranking. It's not a football, it's not the SES. So when you talk about unhealth, and you look at poverty, there is a poverty belt, and you look at that dark blue, Florida is a little different. It's in the South, but it's a little different. We know why it's different. And so when you talk about mapping poverty, there are geographic locations where poverty is concentrated, and there's very predictable. If you go to those counties where high poverty, you can predict exactly who's most likely to be in long-term poverty. If you talk about diabetes, now you keep this mental picture in your mind of these various maps I'm showing. There is diabetes belt, and the darker the area, the higher the percentages. And when you talk about race, place, and space, these maps will really come home. There is an uninsured belt. People who are most likely to be uninsured. And again, the dark green, there's a regional bias here. The southern tier states tend to have the largest. Stroke belt. Where are people stroking out? Look at that dark area. And again, there's a southern bias going on as to what this belt is. There is a fat belt. I'm sorry, obesity belt. And the state that has the highest percentage of obesity is Mississippi. The skinniest state is the dark green. Mountain High, Colorado. Right? So when we start talking about these areas, geography of vulnerability in terms of health and access to different kinds of opportunities, here is the asthma. Asthma, geographical area mapped according to states. And so when we look at the vulnerability and we look at something like food, this term food desert. And we used to have this, 25, 30 years ago. We just said, we ain't got no grocery store. We didn't call it a food desert. We just said, we ain't got no grocery store. We know what a desert is. A desert is a place where there's not a whole lot. This photograph has nothing to do with anything other than I was in Egypt last year. Access to food. Here's a map from USDA. Where no cars and no supermarket. Double whammy. It's hard to shop for groceries on a bus. And in some cases, the buses don't stop where you need to go. And so the dark red areas are areas where you have the dark red as well as the heavy areas is where you have high concentration of food deserts and people who don't have cars. Well, 95% of the people in this country own cars. We are basically an automobile nation. However, however, car ownership is not universal. There are certain populations that are disproportionately carless. No, I didn't say careless. I said carless, not a typo. And so when we talk about supermarket flight, something like that, you know, a lot of places just, supermarkets just left. And if you look at the fact that a lot of our communities would like to have whole food stores. And some people say, that's not a whole food. It costs money to eat healthy. They said, that's not whole food, that's whole paycheck. And so some people say, we'd settle for half food. So when we deal with this whole issue of healthy foods, we got reams and reams of data. We know fresh fruits and vegetables, access to healthy foods. We know all of the data. We know all. But in reality, as it gets put down with the rubber hits the ground and policies are in place, and where investments are made, we know that all communities don't have access to full-service grocery stores, farmers markets, and fresh fruits and vegetables. So we have a rise of community gardens, urban agriculture. And so we have all these occurring in urban communities and cities all across the country as an alternative to the fact that, you know, you don't have institutionalized markets. This is New Orleans, and the red dots, this is a study that was done at Tulane School of Public Health. Supermarkets, the red dots are the supermarkets that were before in place before Katrina, and the green dot in the east. The one dot, these are the grocery stores that were there before Katrina. There's one grocery store. There's at least, you know, 70,000 people in the east, in this area, that have to shop at this one grocery store, Winn-Dixie. It's crowded all the time. Understanding access. This is not a poverty pocket. This is not a low-income area. This is an area that is middle-income homeowners. There are at least, you know, a half dozen subdivisions that are built on man-made lakes, gated communities. So it's not, you know, it's not impoverished people. But no matter if you are impoverished or if you living behind a gated community, you got to eat. And people who don't have cars are up the creek, and we know which one. So this is Houston. This is the city I just moved to. You look at the breakout of red dots and access to grocery stores and the concentrations, lack thereof, near the blue. This is Chicago, the south, southern part of Chicago. They call it the South Side. You know, huge food desert. Access to unhealthy food, as was discussed earlier. In many urban neighborhoods, it's easier to get a greasy hamburger, not tofu burger, a greasy hamburger and fries than it is to get fresh fruits and vegetables. We want our kids to eat healthy, but at the same time, what we get in terms of reality is unhealthy. And so when we talk about unhealthy food and access and what the end result is, it's not good. And so we talk about this greening. We talk about how can we fix this problem by going to something that is more sustainable and green and renewable. And so we get this greening of America. The greenest cities. This is Sustain Lane, did the top 20 greenest cities in the country. Look at that, you know, the top 10. And you'll see these cities come up over and over and over again in terms of green cities. Portland, San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, New York, Boston. I mean, these are places where the government, city, county government, had decided that they're going to invest in green and they're going to invest in sustainability. Now, you will see, again, that southern cities have not done as good a job as they should in terms of moving their policies to start addressing this stuff. You see a lot of, you know, cities in California and on the West Coast doing stuff from the state of Washington all the way down to whatever. I'm not saying that they're perfect or whatever, but in terms of investing, you'll see that they'll show up in a lot of these maps. The most walkable cities, San Francisco, New York, Boston, the city that I just moved from, Atlanta, do not walk, run. They will run you over, pick up trucks, do not bike. Pickup trucks will run you over. And so there, the top 10 cities, there's an absence of southern cities. The places or the cities where you're most likely to get hit, pedestrian fatalities. Look at the top cities, southern cities. No investment in infrastructure, no bicycle lanes, no sidewalks, no pedestrian crosswalks and signage, and et cetera. So you look at Florida, Arkansas, North Carolina, Kentucky, Texas, Alabama. You know, you look at the top 10, they all southern. Now, we know the benefits of, we have lots of data on the benefits of going green and green economy, clean energy. I talked about this. Clean energy, we're spending money in investment. It's not enough. $243 billion in new investments in clean energy in 2010. However, that's still small. Only 10% of our total electricity generation in 2009 was from renewables. The rest of it is still that coal and gas. Okay, here's a map. The states that have put in place renewable energy portfolios. These are the states that are saying we're going to move to renewables and try to get off fossil fuels, and we're going to try to do something about carbon, climate, etc. The green are the states that have done it. The white states are the white is the areas that have basically not done very little. Look at, there's a lot of white in the South. They haven't done much. Top 10 cities that are ready for climate change. Look at those cities. Not one southern city. Now, if you look at the places where climate change is most likely to be felt first, worst, and hardest, those Gulf Coast states and the North, I mean, those along the southern East Coast. Again, this is not my idea. These are different magazines that have reports that have laid out. Energy use in the United States, the low-hanging fruit for energy, good clean energy, is electricity, power, electricity, and transportation. Cleaning up dirty power plants and doing something about our transportation system. Lots of jobs in infrastructure, green economy. Lots of jobs. Did you see that? Lots of jobs. We're hooked on coal. We're not doing very much. Dirty energy is killing a lot of people. There are a lot of health benefits from going to clean and renewable. Getting our transportation act together, we waste a lot of energy. We're stuck in traffic wasting gas, wasting money, and polluting. When gas goes up, we spend a lot of money. I mean, we're spending money and it's costing us. And so when we talk about our cars, we bail out General Motors and we wanted them to go green, but a green Humvee, I don't think so. And so when we talk about, you know, we talk about hybrids, I love my Prius, but that's not enough. Private ownership, when Katrina happened, people say, why don't you just get in that Lexus and drive out? But the fact is that 34% of black people in New Orleans don't own cars. Same percent in Atlanta. We know cars give us liberty, but they also give us something else. Transportation-induced pollution is creating lots of problems. The smog, most vulnerable populations, children. The ultimate price, asthma. These are asthma capital. These are worst places with asthma in terms of all top 10 or top 5 disproportionately in the South. Roads, I wrote a book called Highway Robbery. That sucking sign you hear, we spend more money. 80% of our transportation dollars goes to roads, 20% for transit. That needs to flip. We need to green our transit, more jobs, cleaner air. You build them and they will come. 40-lane highway, it'll fill up. We're building roads to hell, bridges to hell. I mean, we're building Forks, you know, Trails to Hell, even making movies. So when this is the last slide. In order for us to address a lot of these issues in terms of development, in terms of the built environment and impact in health, we have to become less automobile dependent. It makes us much healthier. We can save money. We can save in terms of going to war for oil. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we can do ultimately. Justice and sustainable communities. If we are to become a sustainable community, if we are to grow smarter and fairer, we must address these legacy issues that have been buried for centuries. Thank you very much.